welcome to the Sprocket Podcast, where we are simplifying the good life. My name is Brock Dittus.
And I'm Aaron Flores, trying not to swear as much from the People's Republic of Portland, nestled in the heart of Cascadia.
We are the show that brings you somewhat irreverent conversations, but not too irreverent, about the intricacies of thinking locally, with a global perspective and enjoying the best that life has to offer along the way.
Covering bicycling, trains in transit, and simpler living, and today, 1 billion bicycles.
That's a lot of bicycles.
To put it in this perspective, you know how I own one bicycle? Think of that with times 1 billion.
That's a lot of zeros. Let alone the number of bicycles you would have. Think about all the zeros you would have to make room for somewhere. Yeah. So we talked to Bojan Bjorkman Chiswell from thebikeinmylife.com.
That was an amazing pronunciation, by the way.
Thank you. I labored long and hard over it because it's not one of those intuitive names. She was kind enough to send me an email telling me how to say her name because we forgot to ask her, you know, when we talked to her. So, anyways, we're going to roll that interview a little bit later on. But first of all, you had an experience running through puddles.
I have an experience. What was that? Yesterday. Yesterday I was rolling over to your place because we were heading out to Kelly Park.
Yeah, Kelly Point Park. Beautiful ride.
Excellent ride.
It's been wet lately.
And yeah, so it's been, snowy and then it got warm, so all that snow melted. Oh yeah, and it rained a lot too.
Yeah, yeah. Just precipitation of many kinds coming out of the sky,
yep,
landing on the ground, and staying there in whatever form.
And so they become puddles. And out where I live, where the streets are not so great.
Big holes.
Big holes in them. They form deep puddles. And I kind of like to roll through them, and despite the fact that I'm not always prepared to do so.
Well, who doesn't, right? It's like stepping in a puddle in boots when you're a kid.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
It never gets old.
Yeah, there's just something about jumping in this pool of water and just watching it spray in all directions around you. Yeah, I guess it recalls back to that, happy memory of my childhood.
That's right.
Which there are far too few anyway, so, you know, why not relive them?
Right, right.
crossing 82nd, right across from where I was at on Mill, I believe. Right across there is just a big puddle, and I'm stopped at the light waiting for it to turn, and there's a guy pulls up next to me on his bike, kind of fretish, for lack of a better descriptor.
Wearing some lycra.
Middle-aged white dude wearing some lycra in his safety gear. And, we make eye contact, and he says good morning, and I say hello, and, we kind of have this moment of camaraderie. And I was even thinking to myself at that point, what a great moment of diplomacy.
Or right, you're reaching across the aisle. It's someone that you don't dress like. You may not have a lot in common with, but you can say, hello, it's a nice day. And you can both agree on that.
We've got the bike in common, and that's actually one of the things that I was thinking of. It was at least we've got the bike in common and we've got that experience and we're out, riding in somewhat inclement weather. So anyway, directly across the road is this giant puddle, and I could not help but just roll right through it. I took off as soon as the light changed. I took off. I didn't really think I was trying to outdo this guy. It was just, I just shot out in front really easily.
You're the first guy off the blocks.
Yeah, yeah. And so I roll through this puddle and water goes everywhere. And I realized I'm not wearing waterproof shoes.
Just your regular shoes.
Any warm socks or really anything below, my calf.
Right.
And so water just gets all on my shoes and in my feet. And I'm like, oh, fuck. And then directly behind me, I hear, oh, fuck.
So the same thing happened to him.
Well, I'm thinking all the water that I sprayed out, around me, some of it may have gotten on him. Maybe he rolled through it. Maybe, maybe I'm thinking too bad on myself, but yeah.
But there was goodwill.
There was this goodwill, and then like directly after, I like soak this guy. Hi, I want to be your friend. Ah, not really.
Right.
Screw you.
Well, it happens.
It was not intentional. Whoever you are, if you are happen to be listening, I'm sorry I got you wet in your nice clothes.
I'm sure he's okay with that. I'm sure that, yeah, I would hope anyways.
It was raining anyways.
Right.
He was going to get wet one way or another.
You go outside and you don't expect to get wet on a day like that, you have some assumptions that are wrong.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
Well, we also had a windstorm last night, and the windstorm went out right after I finished editing some audio, and so I was happy to have saved the file, and I don't think I lost anything because of the windstorm, other than the ability to walk around the house and see stuff. But candles are great. I forget how much I like a candlelit house until it comes time to actually have to do that.
Yeah. So you and Adele had, like, you know, some candles and got to relive simpler times.
Simpler
together.
Times. Yes. Back when we lived in a cave.
Right.
And drew petroglyphs on the wall.
Oh, that's what the new artwork on the walls are.
Exactly. Yeah. And let's see. What else is there? Oh, there's this guy wrote in. He was saying that he is working on this project called Solar Pad, which looks interesting because it's supposedly the most economic. Well, let's see. It's the most efficient capturing of the sun's light. When you're out in the wilderness or on the road, not near a power outlet, you can use this to capture the sun's energy and then charge your phone or whatever device you're traveling with. So he wrote in about that. I wanted to share that with everybody. Check it out. We'll put a link up on the website to his Kickstarter campaign. And that, what is it, rolling through like the next month, I think, of the beginning of April is when he's done. So if you like charging your devices on the road, wherever you are, if you're a backpacker or a bicyclist or whatever, you might want to know about this. So check it out. And lastly, I went up to Tacoma to see a friend's wedding. And by the way, is it weird if I say I see a friend's wedding? I think that's like the first thought that comes out of my mouth. But
attend a friend's wedding?
Yes, I was there for my friend's wedding.
I mean, unless you were just there specifically just to witness it.
I was there for the spectacle.
Like, I watched it all happen from afar.
Exactly.
With a telescope.
That's right. Yeah,
I just wanted to see it. I didn't want to be there for it.
Yeah. No, we went up there, and after the wedding was done, I hung out with my sister who lives in Tacoma, and there is a new shop up in Tacoma called Broken Spoke, which is surprisingly like Velo Cult. They don't have taps. They don't serve beer there, but they are a shop that has a wide variety of cans of beer, and you can go in and sit at the bar and enjoy your beverage. And you can also have a frame built. You can have your bike fixed, and it's pretty awesome.
That's pretty badass.
So I will also put a link to that.
And hopes for a future trip out to Tacoma, perhaps?
That's right.
And have these guys maybe as guests on the podcast.
Yeah, well, and the cool thing is that Ben, who runs Broken Spoke in Tacoma, actually is familiar with Sky of Velo Cult.
Right.
Because they lived in San Diego at the same time. And I forget if Ben actually worked for Sky or not, but there's at least a lot of overlap there. So, hence the similarity, I would assume.
Yeah. So, I wonder if this is becoming sort of the new thing for bike shops now.
Yeah.
Is to be like a little bit more than just a bike shop.
Yeah, I think we shared news sometime within the past year or two about there was a shop in Denver that was opening up that was kind of like this. And from what I understand, there's a bunch of them kind of popping up all over the place.
Yeah.
People like bikes. They like beer. And sometimes they want both in the same room as a business.
Quite often.
Yeah. So it's cool to see. And I guess like whenever the economy takes a hit and people are having a hard time making money, the first thing you do is start selling booze because like everyone buys booze.
Well, yeah. So certain luxuries come and go as the economy comes and goes, but the vices are pretty constant. In fact, they tend to be inversely proportional.
Right.
As the economy tanks, the amount of money spent on vices tends to go up.
I wouldn't doubt it because people have to like distract themselves from their troubles in some way or another.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, here's to enjoying the vices without letting the vices ruin you.
True.
And yeah,
and
good
enjoying
times.
Enjoying some vices with the bicycle.
Totally.
I mean, ride responsibly.
Exactly. We would never advocate that anyone go out and do something irresponsible. That would be wrong.
I realized I backed myself into a corner there.
We are not into that. Well, the last really exciting announcement that we have is that we have a partnership with a fledgling radio station here in Portland called X-Ray FM. And that is going to be hitting the airwaves within the next week or so, I think.
Right.
And guess who's going to be on the airwaves?
Doug King Crispin?
Yes, of Kick-Ass Oregon History.
Wow.
Yeah, who we had on the show a long time ago. And
they deserve that. Good. Man, they've been working so hard.
Seriously, guess who else?
Jefferson Smith?
Well, I think he's involved with the station. Sarah Merck's Propaganda from Bitch Media is going to be on there.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And let's see, who else? There's somebody else we know. I forget who it was. I'm going to feel really bad if I miss the shout out. Most excitingly, Aaron, you know who's going to be on the radio? You're going to be on the radio.
No, I'm not.
Yes, you are. You know why?
Because I'm trying not to swear so much.
That's part of it. The Sprocket Podcast is going to be on the air.
Holy shit!
Yeah, seriously. And that's why if you're listening to this on the airwaves, you will notice a little bit of some editing.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's because we keep things. We highly respect and value the work of the FCC, and we want to keep them in, you know, we want to help them out. We want to make their job easier.
Sure.
So.
And, yeah. I mean, whether or not we collectively as humans agree with censorship or whatever, the rules are what the rules are, and we're still play by them as much as we can.
Yes, rules are rules. We're in.
Yep.
So I mean, mostly because it means we get to be on the radio if we follow them, and we don't if not. But yeah, that's going to be if you go to xray.fm is the website, and that will be up both for streaming on the internet and broadcasting from Rocky Butte, I believe, here in Portland, Oregon. So you will hear us there. But that's pretty exciting. So, well, hey, why don't we go to our interview with Bojan Bjerkman-Chiswell?
Yes.
So this is Bojan from thebikeinmylife.com and 1 Billion Bicycles. Thank you so much for taking some time.
Thank you for having me.
So go ahead and tell us a little bit about your project. You were saying it's complex and nuanced.
Well, I tried to make it not so complicated.
Okay.
It has an interesting history, and I guess it's an organic project. So organic projects have a wonderful way of becoming something you didn't expect them to be. So I'll give you a short background. I'm a journalist and a filmmaker by training, and worked a lot in freelancing, but also a lot in public relations for nonprofits. And then I actually just started to ride my bicycle to work as a thing to, you know, I'm an ex-ballerina, and so keeping healthy and fit just was natural for me to do. But because I started to ride to work every day and just never, I was a car driver, would you believe? I just fell in love with getting around on a bicycle. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, as a journalist, it's my natural propensity to ask questions. And I thought, why do more people not use a bicycle to get around? It's so delightful. And out of that, I just started to get more involved in the question, you could say. And I started my first website was actually Melbourne Cycle Chic, which is the Melbourne version of the very famous website Copenhagen Cycle Chic. So they're quite well known. And I emailed the guy and I said, hey, I'd like to start the Melbourne version, and got all the logos from him and all the rest of it. But then it started to get bigger, because as a filmmaker and as a journalist, I started to ask more questions. And it just occurred to me one day, I thought, this is a beautiful research topic for a journalist, something my favorite journalism lecturer always said. He said, as a freelancer, the best thing to do is to find something that really pisses you off and go and investigate it. And so I thought, well, this annoys me. You know, it really annoys me that government, especially in Melbourne, obviously, really seem to lack the ability almost, which I don't think that's true, but it seems like that, to actually consider the bicycle an equal and viable transportation option in the city. And yet we're experiencing really unpleasant traffic congestion, and the bicycle is such a beautiful way to get around. So that's how it began. That's how 1 billion bicycles began. So you could say the website began as a copycat, you could say, of Copenhagen Cycle Chic. And then my idea actually of going around the world and filming and interviewing politicians came from, I guess, my journalism and film background, and this question that just kept popping up in my mind: why is the bicycle not used for transportation in Melbourne? So that's when I went around the world, and so the website has now morphed into the bike in my life, because part of going around the world, I saw a real gap. I saw that there's a worldwide phenomenon of governments not validating, not giving infrastructure to bicycles, and not considering them a really viable, equal form of transportation to the car. And yet that attitude really causes problems for them. You know, they have terrible traffic congestion. So that's really how the two projects are linked, is the website grew bigger once I started to travel the world for the 1 Billion Bicycles filming project. And 1 Billion Bicycles was just a fun name, because before I left Melbourne, I actually Googled how many bicycles are there on the planet, and I discovered there's 1 billion. So okay. I just thought, well, I'll just go around the world and interview as many people and discover as many stories about the 1 billion that happen to be on the planet as I possibly can.
We're going to go find each one.
Well, yeah, that would be great, but it would be difficult. Yeah, so I tried to capture country by country. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm curious, just because you mentioned Melbourne, and that's where you're from.
That's right.
Yeah. What is the situation there? It sounded like it was pretty bleak from what I could find on your site.
Well, I guess Melbourne's very like America. You know, the car really dominates things, and our cities have. I think people, there's a real myth that cities are designed, were originally designed for the car. They never were originally designed for the car, but they have, as the car started to dominate, started to become designed for the car, really to the detriment of livability. But in Melbourne, it's very similar to American cities. You know, the car is dominant, and yet in a very weird way, because the average trip in a car is still only 5 kilometers or 4 miles. So it's this kind of weird situation that you have, where we're experiencing traffic congestion, and yet there's another form of transport that would actually suit the kind of trips that people do in urban environments. So I guess that's Melbourne in a nutshell. And okay. The government seems to really not be particularly friendly towards the people that choose the bicycle of their own free will.
Yeah, it seems like that's kind of a trend in a lot of places. It's like the wrong tool for the job. People need to get places, but they're stuck on this one idea, and there's no political will or really cultural movement in most parts of the world to support that to the point where it would make a big difference.
Yeah, look, I think it's you know, the car is a wonderful thing. It really makes a difference to the world. And we've sort of collapsed it, you know, with a lot of other things. You know, we've kind of collapsed people's humanity with, you know, getting around. And so there's really more human ways to get around other than the car. And so we've kind of used this amazing tool, and we've said, isn't it amazing? And then we've tried to integrate it into everything we do. And yet it is an amazing tool. It's a very inept tool for the things that we want to do in cities. You know, cities are, the definition of a city is transporting, moving rapidly goods, services, ideas, and people. And actually, you can't do that most efficiently with everyone driving cars. Mm-hmm. You know, you can do it with some people driving cars. Obviously, you want your delivery people delivering enormous goods to have a truck, right? It wouldn't make sense on a bicycle. But also you want, you know, bicycles to deliver people around, and you want taxis and you want trains and you want everything. And actually, when we just bring in the car and we let the car do every job out there, we actually get economic meltdown. That's really what happens. You know, Tanzania, in Dar es Salaam, which is the capital of Tanzania, they experience, and look, I'm sure every city has statistics like this. This was just one that blew me away. You know, they are losing billions from their economy simply because they cannot move the city, because the traffic congestion is at a standstill. And I had the experience of, with my camera equipment and everything I had, being kicked out of a taxi because he said, I'm using up too much petrol sitting in this traffic jam, and you'll be faster to walk to your hotel.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, that's where Dar es Salaam is, you know. So governments are experiencing economic inactivity because we've collapsed movability with one form of getting around.
So it's like someone invented the shovel and they said, this is really good for moving things around. And then everyone sat down at the dinner table and said, let's all use these shovels to put food in our mouths. And it's not efficient. Yeah. Doesn't work.
It's a nice analogy. Yeah, really. You know, a shovel doesn't fit inside a human mouth.
Right. So. Nor is it wieldy at the table.
Exactly. Yeah. So really, you know, I think people, you know, when I talk about this, they're in shock, you know, oh, what do you mean I have to get out of my car? And actually, when I speak to people, I'm still to meet the car driver who, when I explain it to them in reality, like, actually, it would make your life easier, that they don't agree with me. So it's really not a difficult concept. I just think it's simply, I really see a lack of vision, you know, someone in politics to just put it out there and say, let's create really great cities that just work for people, that just, never mind how it is we get around. Let's not get caught up in the vehicle. Let's get caught up in the vision for what we love and what makes a city great. And I guess, you know, I sort of focus on the bicycle, but actually what I'm talking about is livability. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not human to sit in a car for 2 hours to get home after work. It's really not, you know, and the statistics are, this is an American statistic, that if your commute in a car is greater than 40 minutes, you will experience greater marital breakdown, you know. So really, that's not human. You know, people are reaching the point where getting to work is becoming a problem for the people you love, you know.
Right. Like we're separated.
I don't see that as workable. You know, they really are finding that the stress and the frustration of sitting in traffic affects how you go home at the end of the day and deal with the people you love and your family. So for me, the bicycle returns livability, it returns humanity, it gives people an opportunity to the journey between work and home to be something that fills them with joy and they get home a better person. That's certainly how I experienced life and why I fell in love with getting around on a bicycle. I literally rode my bicycle as a this very boring functional thing of keeping, you know, getting exercise, and it turned into a passion. I just, every time I get on my bike, I love it. I love my life, you know, and I just see that as, you know, everyone should experience that. You know, no one should have the experience that getting to work is tiresome and frustrating.
Right. Well, it affects the way that your day goes. I'm interested in the idea that it really isn't about the bike. Like, as much as obviously we're a podcast that does a lot of talk about bicycles, but Aaron, you and I live in a town where, because there's so much focus on bicycling in the public eye, it seems like it's easier for it to be about the bike. And that's why you and I derive so much pleasure of making fun of different kinds of bicyclists. And it's very possible it could be counterintuitive, I suppose. But yeah, like urban design and creating a place where people can just be people and be people next to each other. It seems like that addresses a lot of the concerns that you're talking about.
Well, I guess what you could say is, and this is how I like to describe it, is that when you design for the car, you get a different kind of city. You know, you really do. I mean, it's simple things like, that. Here's a beautiful example in San Francisco, where I'm currently living. They've just built a new bridge to cross between, you know, the bay. And they've actually, for the first time, put in a bicycle lane, which is beautiful, right? Except they built the bridge for the car and then they added the bicycle lane. And so the bicycle lane is incredibly windy and very unpleasant to ride.
Okay.
Is it separated from the cars at all?
Yeah, it's separated from the cars. Yeah, it's a total separation. And yet the engineering of the bridge was had the car in mind. You know, it was like, have the cars cross, oh, and we'll put in a bicycle lane. And, you know, even cities, right? You know, there's a place in Melbourne called Docklands, and it's classified by the Al Gore Foundation as one of the worst developments in the Western world.
Really?
Literally.
Wow.
One of the worst. Just everything about it. And I've actually been there on a bicycle, and the wind tunnels, the man-made wind tunnels, by basically building very tall buildings too close together. You know, you can build tall buildings, but you've got to have a certain distance between them, or else you literally get a wind tunnel. And I have been blown off my bicycle down that wind tunnel. And, you know, I'm an adult. I'm a very small adult. I'm only 5'1", but you can imagine a child would literally be blown in front of a car. So those streets, those streets were designed with literally the idea that the human being would be disconnected from their environment. So you don't need to think about the human vulnerability inside of the city, because you're thinking about a car, one ton of metal traveling through the city. So then you get unlivable situations for human beings, and you get people not using the streets, you get people disappearing from the streets, you get crime on the streets because there's no one around, and so there's obviously people are vulnerable. When you change the way you think about the design of a city, when you actually say, you know what, our main form of transportation, not our only form, but our main form, because cities are compact, and, you know, San Francisco is 7x7, 7 miles by 7 miles. That's very bicycleable, doable on a bicycle. And if you consider that the bicycle is now your main form of transportation, you will design that bridge completely differently. You will engineer it differently, you know, and it's very easy to protect people from wind. You know, engineers are smart people. I don't think it would be a particularly difficult feat. We've got to the moon and back. We can deal with wind, you know.
That's why they're in charge of building things like that.
That's right. That's why they're in charge. So really it's, you know, and then we would just separate our buildings a little further, and we would do more interesting things with our buildings. You know, there's a design in Japan, a building, and I forget the name of it. It's very famous. And if I had the name, you could Google it. But it's this beautiful design that steps the building backwards away from the street like a staircase, you could say. Huh. And on every level of the staircase is actually a forest of trees. And so what that does is the wind is basically muffled by the trees and prevented from creating these kind of wind tunnels. You know, wind tunnel surfaces are beautifully smooth and they allow the wind to just funnel down, you know, between the buildings. Whereas if you have foliage, the wind really has trouble and it gets stopped and changes direction and it gets muffled, it gets dampened. So if we had the bicycle as our leading, you could say, form of transportation within a city, we would just create more human environments, and we would just make spaces really, really just naturally, the space would occur as more friendly, more beautiful, more aesthetic, more livable. And the brilliance of that is you would then prevent traffic congestion because people would start to voluntarily use the bicycle. You know, currently, let's frankly, it's unpleasant to ride a bicycle in a lot of cities.
Certainly,
you know,
yeah.
The bicycle itself is still beautiful and wonderful. It's the environment that makes getting around on a bicycle a really bad experience, you know. Whereas if you're in the Netherlands, it's a beautiful experience. You know, the bicycle is this beautiful mechanism to get you there, and then getting there is just delightful. You know, the environment really speaks to and is there to sustain, you know, this travel. It's human, it's easy, it's nice. You know, Beijing does it beautifully. Beijing has its main city streets lined with beautiful shade trees, and Beijing gets hot, right? Like really hot.
Yeah. But that was your most recent video that you've posted.
Yeah, it's my last video is Beijing. I haven't completed it yet, but you know that the streets are tree lined, and getting around in the hot summer in Beijing is just beautiful. Those trees are cool. You know, a tree creates 30% less heat. It reduces heat by 30%, which is massive. You know, so you're riding your bike. It's really hot in the sun, and on those bicycle lanes in Beijing, it's like a beautiful, cool summer's breezy day.
That's fascinating.
It's gorgeous. Beijing really does great when it comes to bicycles. So that's really my point is, you know, the bicycle naturally creates more livable, more easy, more human, and just more like pleasant cities to get around in.
Yeah.
And even car drivers are up for that. You know, car drivers want a pleasant city because, you know, if they do want to ride a bicycle occasionally, it's actually pleasant and they can do it.
Yeah. I'm curious just with coming from Melbourne, was there a similarity? Because obviously you said there were congestion problems there. Is there a similarity where people tend to live a decent way away from where they work?
Yeah, look, absolutely. You know, as cities expand, and Melbourne is a massive city, it just sprawls forever, right? But there's even ways to deal with that. You know, it's one of the things that sort of, you know, in America and Australia, we have this beautiful excuse, oh, but, you know, we live in a big city and it's sprawling. And there are other cities in the world that have dealt with that just beautifully. Copenhagen is one. It's a smaller city than Melbourne, but they still have a problem with people not wanting to ride 20 kilometers to work, which is perfectly normal.
Natural.
I don't want to ride 20 k's to work either. You know, I couldn't wear my heels and, you know, arrive looking, you know, like a bike babe, could I? You know, it's just natural that people only want to ride 10 kilometers, 7 miles at the absolute most. And Copenhagen dealt with that this beautiful way. They created a new train carriage, which was incredibly easy to get your bicycle on and off. And they literally had a increase of the millions of people using the train system simply by adding a bicycle carriage or two. You know, people who traveled 20 k's to work now use their bicycle. They'd go halfway on the train and the other half on the bicycle. And people who, you know, use their bicycle a lot could now use the train on a rainy day, and, you know, all that stuff. It just blossomed, the number of people riding the bike. They didn't have to advertise. They didn't have to force people. They just provided a service that worked for people to use the bicycle, and people naturally opted for the bicycle.
Yeah, the trend kind of spreads naturally.
It was just totally natural. And I think people often think, you know, in America and Australia, oh, we're going to have to force people out of their cars. And I say, actually, when you provide infrastructure, people naturally choose the bicycle. You know, the Netherlands has never had to force people. They've created the infrastructure that works and is safe, and people actually choose 50% of the time, and this is the statistic, it's 50% of the time they choose the bicycle. And the 50%, they choose the car. And it just works out beautifully, you know. And then other cities, you know, people always say to me, oh, but Copenhagen's tiny. Of course they could manage that. And I say, well, actually, Berlin is 9 times the size of Paris. And they also are dealing with this beautifully. They have an enormous city. And what they're looking at is basically strengthening the economy, not just centrally, but in 12 regions of the city, so that they can start to create 12 economic hubs, which is diversifying your economic situation. So you're actually stabilizing your economy. And so that people are now able to get a job closer to their home.
Right. They can travel a smaller distance and that's be okay right. with that because they that's have everything right. they need in that hub.
In that hub. And so now you're getting within, and it's still being managed by the one government, but they're just really, you know, looking at a different city model. They're actually saying, we don't need a city. It isn't functional. It isn't the best way to create a city that is just like everyone crams into the one space.
Yeah.
It's much more powerful to have a really big city with 12 strong hubs. And, you know, people can obviously, some people will go between the hubs. Many people will go between the hubs, but you're more likely to be able to get a job maybe three hubs away or in your own hub rather than, you know, across the other side of town. So that's how they're dealing with it. So it's just really getting clever and getting, you know, getting innovative. The bicycle provides this beautiful opportunity to get really innovative with our cities and start to naturally solve some of the problems that we're experiencing when we continue to just allow the car to, you know, somehow dominate everything without saying it's not really supporting what it is we want for ourselves.
Yeah, I think that model really speaks to a lot of what, at least my experience here in America, what is people's resistance to accepting the bicycle as a viable form of transportation. And that's the whole idea of we're all sprawled outside of the city and then we all try to cram back into the city, you know, to work or for entertainment or for whatever reason. And then we all got to like sprawl back out of the city for, you know, our daily lives or for, you know, because that's where we live. And that model's not working. That model.
Yeah. And look, that resistance you talk about, you say, what is that resistance? It's really natural, you know, like really, you know.
Oh, yeah.
It's scary to ride a bicycle in some cities. You know, that's just natural. And when people say, oh, you know, car drivers are just stubborn and they won't get out of their cars and they're wedded to their cars, I'm like, no, they're not. They're really not. They're just reacting to what's actually reality for them.
Yeah, I think we accept that as just sort of as matter of fact. Yep, I live 20 miles out of the city, but I have to work in the city. And so I'm going to have to use this car.
What can you do?
Yeah.
That's right.
What can I do?
Yeah.
You know?
And, you know, and someone in LA, and I tell you what, I have only been to LA briefly, but wow. Wow.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the people there have literally lost the concept of walking to the shop because it's literally so, like, inhuman. To do that, you know, you've got to cross big, scary roads. There isn't footpaths. There isn't pedestrian crossings. So, of course, you're not going to just naturally say, oh, I'm going to walk today or ride my bike. The only time people naturally, without being forced, say, I'm going to do something is if it's easily doable, you know. And so, you know, this tagline that this people say is build the lanes and people will come is really what happened with the car. You know, the car started out as inappropriate for cities. You know, it was actually, I don't know if you know this, but it was the bicycle lobby that created smooth streets
right,
in America.
Right, pavement, yeah.
Yeah, because the bicycle came along. It was very popular, but the streets were made for horse and cart.
Right, and so it was known as the bone shaker for a while.
That's right. Whereas the American League of Wheelmen, they started to lobby for paved streets, you know, because it just worked well for the bicycle. And the car, you know, then really benefited from that. And so it's like actually people started to use the car not necessarily because it was so wonderful. It actually was provided for. You know, like it became easy because there were certain things in place. It, you know, it wasn't easy to drive a car on rough roads because the car's wheels were like a bike wheel. They were actually quite small and didn't suit rough roads either. And so when the American League of Wheelmen came along and started paving the roads, suddenly the car now had the ability to get around easier as well, you know. And so what we forget is that actually if you just make something possible, it's a natural thing for people to want to try it out. It's a natural thing for people to test it out. You know, when we put these bicycle shares in cities, it's just really natural for someone to come along and check it out, you know, and give it a shot. And if they have a bad time when they test it because the infrastructure's not there and all that stuff, they're never going to try it again. If they have a good time because everything's there in place, they'll just naturally keep doing it.
Does San Francisco have bike share right now? I can't remember which cities
Yeah, it does. They brought it in literally as I arrived.
Oh, really? Okay. In your honor, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the story I'm sticking to. So, they have a bike share. But actually, you know what? I have a real gripe around bike shares around the world. My gripe is they're awful bicycles.
They don't tend to be, not that anyone needs a performance bicycle when they rent one, but they tend to be heavy.
They are a really bad ride. They really are. And, you know, and that's what I have a gripe because I'm like, you know what, once again, you're forging this myth that riding a bicycle is having a bad time. Yeah. You know, people are going to get on that bike and, you know, people don't know a lot about bicycles. They're really not a phenomenon most of us know a lot about, you know. I didn't realize that not all bicycles were created equal when I first started to ride my bicycle.
Sure.
I had this terrible old thing and I just thought, oh yeah, whatever, that's a bike.
And I'm going to have to live with it. Live with the sweat.
That's right. I have to live with the sweat and I have to live with all the having the bad time. And then my sister, who had more money than me at the time, she bought this beautiful, you know, $2,000 bicycle and I got on it and I was like, oh, this is a bicycle. The thing that I have is, I don't know what it is. It's not a bicycle, though. And she actually got me to purchase a proper, decent bicycle.
There you go.
So, yeah, and it makes a difference. And so I get really upset when cities, you know, have this thing, oh, we're going to promote cycling. And I'm like, well, you're not promoting it because that bicycle's a real tough ride. You know, it's heavy, it's uncomfortable, it's everything about it, you know.
I would imagine part of the choice that goes into that is that they want something that's going to be bulletproof because, you know, they might be subject to damage or abuse or something like that. So they want a tank that's going to last forever. But the problem with that is that it's as heavy as a tank is. So,
well, you're absolutely right. It is so that the bike doesn't get stolen. But there are better ways to do that. I don't know if you know the bicycle share in Barcelona. They've done it brilliantly. They've created a bicycle that's very lightweight, looks just like a bicycle, except all the components are ridiculously ridiculous. So the front wheel's quite small and the back wheel's quite large, and you couldn't fit any of those components to any other normal bicycle.
Right, yeah, it's designed specifically for this one model, and it wouldn't do any good to steal the parts.
No, it wouldn't do any good to steal the parts. And yes, you could steal the bicycle, but obviously they have tracking systems and all the rest of it. So they don't have this ridiculous problem of a horrible bicycle, and they have the world's best bicycle share. They have more people using their bicycle share than anywhere else in the world.
Barcelona.
Simply because their bicycles are great, comfortable, easy ride bicycles, and people love them. And in fact, their bicycle share scene was so popular that they couldn't keep up with the number of people wanting to actually use it.
Right.
Yeah, which is definitely not the case in any other city. Every other city is really kind of struggling to, people to take it up and continue to use it.
Yeah.
So it's really, you know, it's this whole thing of, you know, once again, we're not providing sufficient and adequate infrastructure for people to actually have a good time on a bike. Mm-hmm. And so we're not seeing people choosing it. It's just natural that they wouldn't choose it.
Right. So we need to make the barriers to entry not quite as hard to surmount, perhaps. I'm curious if we could transition just around sweat, as sometimes we do.
Sure.
I know you talk a fair deal about what it takes to get women on bicycles, and depending on which part of the world you're in, which city you're in, there may be more or less women using bicycles as transportation. Yeah. But I would imagine, like, one of the most common things I can think of when women talk about wanting to bike or not wanting to bike is, like, I'm going to show up and look bedraggled. And
that's right.
And you've addressed a little bit of that in your writing on the website, I believe, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, look, I address that try to address that in many, many ways. First of all, just if you look at the way the bicycle's been advertised for a very long time, and I don't need to diminish men, but it is a phenomenon.
Right. And it's okay. You can diminish men. We're okay with that here.
Well, I don't want to diminish you, but I want to present something that I think guys are not aware of, is that the advertising around bicycles is very masculine and it really doesn't appeal to women at all. You know, it's very, you know, a man on a bicycle riding down the face of a mountain, and guys look at that and they're like, awesome.
Right.
Women look at that and say, you know, and so really, and I don't mean to diminish women in that way. You know, some women are like, oh, I love mountain biking. I'm like, so do I.
Right.
But your average, and I don't mean average, like most women, let's face it, we like to wear our high heels. I have pink high heels. They're my favorite heels, right? And I want to wear them on my bicycle, right? And I have my suit that I purchased, and it's cost me a lot of money, and I don't want to get grease on it. So I try to approach it in many ways, and I have a whole lot of secrets, Bicycle Babe secrets, which you can read about on my website as well. Things like my favorite secret is a particular soap that I use.
I was just reading that because this was news to me.
Yeah, it's a very cool soap, and guys can use it as well. It's brilliant. It actually is made of elemental sulfur. It's totally natural. It's been used since the time of the Egyptians, and it literally naturally prevents bacterial growth. It balances the pH of the skin, and sweat doesn't smell. It's just water, basically.
Right, bacteria smells.
Bacteria smells, and bacteria likes to grow in moist environments. So, and the other thing I say to women is, And this is the kind of male domination, is we associate the bicycle with the advertising that is out there.
Sure.
And there's just a lot of men in Lycra with helmets doing the Tour de France thing. So when that advertising remains the sort of only way that we talk around bicycles, but women just naturally think, well, I am not Lance Armstrong. I never wanted to be. I never will be.
And that's the only message in the popular culture.
And that's the only message that they receive. So I, you know, for me, I ride real slow. I am in no rush to get anywhere on my bicycle.
We're big fans of that.
Yeah. And yet I get to places faster than most people, you know, because I have a beautiful bicycle, which there's no work involved. It rides for me, basically. I just move the pedals slowly. It goes very fast, very easily. So that's the first thing, is a proper bicycle. You know, something, once again, you know, people think the Kmart bicycle for $120 is the same as the beautiful Velorbus, you know, bicycle from Copenhagen. You know, so there's just a lot of misinformation.
Right. Indeed, those two are not similar.
Yeah, yeah. And there's a lot of misunderstanding and misinformation. And the way that I'm trying to shift that is through my website, you know, talking about it, telling people about it. I had a conversation with a taxi driver the other day and told her, you know, yes, there's a difference between your $120 Kmart bicycle and the $2,000 bicycle that I ride. And she said to me, she goes, you know, you make riding a bicycle sound fun. And I said, well, it is fun. And she said, I've never considered it fun. I said, well, that's because you're on a $120 Kmart bicycle and you wonder why you can't get up the hill.
Right, right.
So it's really that, you know, women don't know these things because they haven't been advertised, because it's really this, it's brilliant marketing. The Tour de France thing caught on, and the marketeers of that, with all their sporting equipment and their helmets and their lycra and their funny shoes and their this, that, and the next thing, just started to dominate, not because it needed to, not because anyone sort of asked for it. It was just a brilliant marketing campaign. And so it appeals to men because they love the Tour de France. And yet, unfortunately, it suppressed women riding. And it's kind of dominated so much that we've forgotten that actually there's a different way to ride a bicycle. There's sure. different kinds of bicycles. There's all this, there's different accessories for bicycles, all this stuff, right? So, yeah, that's really it, is we have to have, you know, the two realms. The sports bicycling has to be completely separated from the commuter bicycling. And unfortunately, guys kind of collapse them because they're interested in both. And we need to find a way that separate, you know, we don't talk about rally driving when we sell a car to someone.
Right.
You know?
Although that's how the commercials will present it to you as well.
And the guys love that. The guys yeah. love thinking their car is like a rally car.
I'm
right?
going to get that one that throws up big clouds of dust.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Whereas you do notice that there's also advertising for women.
Sure.
Around cars, whereas there's not advertising for women around bicycles. So it's a real missing in the world, right, of this thing of like actually creating a space where women can step into and actually want to do this activity that looks like it might be absolutely hideously awful,
sure.
considering you have to go down the face of a sheer cliff, you know. So it's really how we you know, women will ride a bike, and in fact, they prefer the bicycle more than men. Like in countries like Amsterdam and Copenhagen, mostly women okay. ride the bicycle.
And countries like Portland,
there's
a very large proportion of lady commuters out around this
yeah.
town. Like I would say, when I go out and ride just to and from work. I would say at least half of the commuters, if not more, are women. And
yeah,
I don't know if
yeah.
that's just the route I'm choosing or if that reflects a trend, but I'm impressed.
It's your bias. It's your bias. You're just naturally, you know, trying to follow the girls on bikes, isn't it? Yeah.
Probably so. Yeah.
yeah.
But making the distinction between sport and every other use of the bike yeah. then is what you're saying. It's like, and we have to clarify too, like we got a couple listeners that love sport bike stuff.
Sure.
And
yeah.
we're not against that. It's just that like you're saying, the messaging of that, I think, sometimes gets in the way of getting more people, and certainly women, also men. Like I'm not like a manly man in that I don't do sports and things, and so I think I've always kind of latched onto this idea that you can use a bike without being a competitive racer, because I'm not that kind of I'm not that driven, I guess. So yeah, this message I think is very important yeah. to get out there.
And going with the whole car and advertisement analogy, I think the way bikes are advertised, if you were to draw a parallel to that, it's as if all we're seeing are advertisements for Ferraris and for, you know, I don't know, high performance trucks or Alfa
yeah.
Romeos. You know, that would be the way I've seen bicycle advertised. And there's a whole world of other bicycles out there that are not sports bicycles, that are not mountain downhill bicycles. You know,
yeah,
those,
totally.
They're fun and they're fine, but that's just one piece of a greater world out there.
It's like
totally.
Never knowing about the existence of a minivan.
That's yeah. right. Yeah, you know, I think we don't have ads for just Ferraris for bicycles. We have monster trucks.
Okay.
yeah, yeah, yeah. And that too.
You know,
yeah.
like a mountain bike occurs to me as like riding a monster truck. Like it is. I've done mountain biking once. Never again.
Like, just not your
never.
Thing.
Never. Like, I am just in awe of anyone who can go mountain biking because it is just, it was the most terrifying thing I've ever done in my life. I cried half the way and I was covered in bruises and scratches and I will never get on a mountain bike and go down a mountain again. But I absolutely think it is the most wonderful thing I've ever seen. And anyone who's into that, I'm like, wow, you're amazing.
You go do that.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, but it really has to be separated, you know, and it's really, it's like everything in our cities, you know, it's like, what are we up to at, you know, bringing the car into tiny spaces? You know, why are we only advertising the mountain bike? It's, we're just limiting ourselves. You know, we're just limiting what's possible. You know, there's way more things possible, way more interesting things, way more exciting things, way more workable things if we just really stop putting the lid on what's possible because we get fascinated with the car or we get fascinated with, you know, sports cycling and safety equipment, you know, like, you know, in Melbourne, we have this helmet debate and we're just getting fascinated by the helmet, right?
it's like, almost like a red herring.
It's like, really, that's not the conversation that's important here. You know, the conversation that's important is how do we design a city where you don't need safety equipment? You know, it's been done before. You know, Copenhagen and Amsterdam, kids ride to school by themselves on the streets because, as you'll see in my Amsterdam video, the guy said in the Netherlands, we have the attitude, don't clean up the mess afterwards. Don't have the mess. Like, don't have the accident. Put everything in place that literally rules out an accident between a car and a bicycle.
This makes sense. Yeah.
And so whereas in America and Australia, especially Australia, because it's mandatory helmet laws, we are solving the problem from the wrong end. You know, let's not make it safe and then hope that a helmet will vaguely keep your brain alive when your neck's broken. You know, like really. Like, yeah. I don't mean to be like, that's graphic, right? But it really comes down to that.
No, it makes sense. The helmet is sort of it's indicative, I think, of a bigger problem, you know, and that is maybe bicycling in a specific environment is not particularly safe. Well, then maybe the helmet isn't necessarily the solution. The solution should be, well, what makes bicycling unsafe? What is in place and what are the things that makes the helmet so necessary? And then I think it comes down to, you know, sharing the road with vehicles that maybe aren't as safe as the bicycle, or having to be on roads with vehicles that are much more dangerous to cycle with.
Yeah, and we also collapse the problem as the bicycle's the problem. When we have a situation where, you know, we get conflicts between cars and bikes, we have it that, oh, it's too unsafe for the bicycle to be on the road, therefore get rid of them, rather than, hang on a second, we want to get our city moving. What's the best way to get people moving? Okay, let's get people moving in the best way possible and then create the city around getting people moving, you know, rather than let's create a city around allowing a car to drive at a speed that only cars can be around.
Yes.
You know? So we sort of, it's like backwards, right? It's like where we have the car and it presents problems, so we accommodate the car some more to prevent the problems rather than saying,
right,
what is our goal for the city? What's our purpose for the city? You know, our purpose is to move people freely and easily and quickly and pleasantly and peacefully and all the rest of it. And you can do that in multiple ways. And the car is one way. And it's beautiful for particular kinds of travel. And it's really inept and inappropriate for other kinds of travel. So that's why I say it's not about the bicycle, because it's really about the livability of our cities. And, you know, trams and trains are part of that whole equation. You know, I say you can't have a bicycle city without a beautiful transportation system.
Sure.
And, you know, it's just we need to look at the problem as not a problem, as an opportunity. You know, it's a real opportunity to take cars off the road. It provides some beautiful things. You know, there was in San Francisco, there was a highway that was a double-story highway. America, like, you guys have this amazing, like, multi-level highway thing. It just blows me away.
It's
but
a transportation sandwich.
Whoa. It's something else, I tell you what. But they built this multi-level highway on the seafront, you could say. And what happened in the 1996 or 86, I can't remember which one it was. I think it was an earthquake. You guys will probably have the date better than I will. But there was a really big earthquake in San Francisco. And that particular highway, and let's just say the goddess of bike babes was involved. That
watching
highway
over the whole process, yeah.
Collapsed, right? And opened up the seafront. And what happened was is the government was like, that's a really nice seafront. We'd forgotten it was there because there was a great big highway running across it, and they never rebuilt the highway.
We'll keep it, yeah.
Yeah, they actually kept it. And I've got photographs like now that I have tweeted that there's a bike share where the freeway used to be, and that it's called the Embarcadero. It's now the hottest tourist spot in San Francisco.
Right.
No kidding. No kidding. It's along the sea. There's all these markets. There's all these shops. Like, business is booming, right, along that space where a freeway collapsed and they never replaced it. And, in fact, it was such a brilliant outcome from a freeway collapsing that the San Francisco government is, like, looking at ways to, like, have, like, human-made earthquakes to get rid of those additional – no, really.
Yeah.
They're like – how do we get rid of more highways, these multi-level highways? Because they didn't notice any traffic congestion. They actually noticed an improvement in the traffic congestion when that massive highway just disappeared overnight.
Yeah,
right?
And I believe Seattle is actually also working on removing their viaduct highway, which has been dominant on their waterfront area for a good long
while.
Yeah.
You know, so it's one of those things. They kept having to accommodate the car rather than, hang on a second, like, this is a city for people. And, you know, it just makes no sense to have cars dominate our sea frontage. So it's really just looking at cities from a different perspective and stop getting caught up in the way we move. Just really look at why we want to move, you know. And if you look at why we want to move, you'll get a closer access to how to get there. You know, oh, why I want to move is I want to get my kids to school safely 5 kilometers away. If that's your motivation, there's a million ways to do that that
right.
doesn't involve a car.
Spark the imagination.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Well, cool. We should probably wrap up here for time's sake, but also want to direct people to, I believe, your video from Mozambique talked a lot about the use of bicycles in personal mobility and how that was making the difference between people being able to get where they need to go and not being able to go there. So some great coverage on that. Did you want to say anything about that before we wrap
up? Yeah, sure. So my Mozambique video is on Vimeo, and I'm gonna launch it on my website and actually – in the coming week. So that's perfect segue. Thank you. So my Mozambique one is the beginning of our African film series. We're raising money to complete the African film series. So everyone's welcome to donate. We have the footage, we need to edit it. And so we started with the Mozambique video. It was just the most beautiful story. You know, I recommend people watching it because the person that I found, and I don't manufacture my stories. I go out into the street with my camera and they find me, you know, they really do. And this man, he has a bicycle wheelchair. And so people can also donate to purchase bicycle wheelchairs. I have a contact in Mozambique and they make the bicycle wheelchairs specially for people. So people can donate to that as well. And yeah, it literally turned his life into life rather than, you know, someone who literally, he has polio and he cannot get anywhere without his bicycle. And, you know, a car just wouldn't cut it because he's poor. He doesn't have a lot of money. And so providing him with a car where he has to buy petrol, et cetera, and maintenance would just be a disaster for his life, you know.
Of course, yeah.
And also providing him with a fancy, expensive wheelchair would be a disaster for his life. The bicycle wheelchair is this amazing mechanism that's just like gets him everywhere and anywhere he needs to go. It's a little hand-powered car, you could say, and he gets around, he has a job, he's now able to earn income for his family and his wife and his children. He bought his wife, you know, you don't see this in the interview because I had to cut it out, but, you know, he bought his wife new clothes, and that was just the most magical thing to him, you know, to buy his wife new clothes. So it makes the bicycle for him, as he says, is a life. You know, it's so powerful. This very simple thing is so powerful. And, you know, it's powerful not, you know, and we sort of think, oh, yeah, it's powerful for people in Africa because they're poor and they can't afford cars. It's actually powerful for ourselves. You know, it is the difference to shift our cities from places where, you know, Americans lose their marriages because they're stuck in a traffic jam, and this bicycle could literally shift the way their marriage goes. You know, it's powerful stuff. And, you know, it's just as powerful for the wealthy Westerner as it is for the, you know, the person in the developing country who has polio and, you know, lives in a mud house. Like, it's literally has the power to span every, you know, income, like, lifestyle, everything. It affords you, it has the ability to afford everybody freedom and ease and economic benefit.
And we can get behind that. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk, Bojan. Really appreciate it.
You're most welcome. It's a delight talking to you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and again, it's thebikeinmylife.com.
Yes, it is.
All right. Well, that was a great interview with Bojan.
I am in love with her voice.
Yes.
Can I say that?
She has a nice voice.
She has a great voice.
And we respect what she does.
Something about the Australian accent.
Hmm. Well, hey, how about some news?
Let's do some news.
All right.
What can compare with the thrill of a brand new bike?
I like my bike. It's fast. I like my bike. It's fast. I like my bike. It's fast. It circles around the city lights.
From Critical Transit sends to us a link with a video of the pedal-powered snowplow.
Yeah, and this is pretty awesome because this is the sort of thing that I have wondered. It's kind of like the pedal-powered lawnmower,
yeah,
which I have always wondered if that's possible or not. And I would like to have one of these. I guess it doesn't snow enough, but here, check out the video. I was playing it now.
I think you emailed me that link too.
It's a trike, and it's got a plow attached to the front
with a box on the back.
Box on the back. I'm curious what the box is for. There's not so much explanation about that, but
I imagine you just need some weight on there.
Probably so. Yeah, just to hold it down.
Yeah.
So it's like bags of sand in the back of your pickup truck or something like that. Okay. Yeah. Anyways, that's pretty awesome. And of course, Jeremy at Critical Transit is a cool guy. So. Holding it down in Minneapolis.
Yeah.
He did say.
I think this was like in part maybe suggestion for those of us in a city without snowplows when it does snow.
You should have one of these.
Yeah.
Everyone should have one. Yeah. Well, and the trike also addresses the stability that I would like more stability sometimes on a human power device.
Certainly.
When I'm out on the ice or the snow, that sort of thing. Speaking of stability, I saw an orange elf from Organic Transit. Just not an hour ago, out
really?
On Stark Street, yeah.
I swear I saw one on Burnside on Saturday.
Oh, was it orange?
No, it was blue.
Oh, okay. Not the same one then.
No.
Unless they painted it. Yeah, it's very possible.
True. I bought this blue one, but now I really wanted orange.
Yeah. And or what if it's like those Hot Wheels that you'd put in warm water and they would change color?
Right.
That would be cool.
They know what temperature it is.
It would serve the same function as a barometer.
That's true. Also, it helps you decide whether or not to use it.
Right.
You know, if the elf is red, I'm taking the bicycle.
Right. If it's blue, I go out on the elf.
I go on the elf. Patent pending.
Yes.
All right. From riskology.co, how to take a refreshing shower on an airplane. I read through this whole thing.
Yeah.
It is freaking genius.
It is.
Have you read through the
I have. I'm a big fan of Tyler's work.
Yeah. So just a little bit here. It's hard enough to stay fresh traveling short distances, but what about when you're an international traveler stuck on a hot plane between two other exhausted travelers fighting for your armrest? This is a problem for every long-haul traveler. Maybe there's an important meeting just after landing. You're meeting someone at the airport. Or just tired and smelly and want to freshen up. But how? Over the years, I've developed a method for taking a nice, refreshing shower mid-flight. It's not the most luxurious spa treatment you'll ever experience, but it's welcome relief from the rigors of travel, and most importantly, will leave you clean and confident that you're not offending the surrounding three rows of passengers.
And he goes on to enumerate all the steps, which you can find on the post on his website, riskology.co. And I would say I have done something very similar to this on the Amtrak train.
Oh, yeah.
And it depends on the bathroom you get. I think the Amtrak bathrooms are not much bigger than airplane bathrooms, so I think these steps would probably apply no matter where you are.
Right. Yeah, I think mostly it addresses just what to do in such a tight area.
Yeah, for sure.
And how to efficiently go about doing it without, you know, dropping your clothes, the clean ones, like on the floor or, yeah.
Definitely. The most interesting part, I think, I mean, there's a lot of interesting parts to this, but the idea that you would leave your shoes outside of the bathroom.
Yes, like as a signal, like someone's in here and I'm going to be a while.
It reminds me of, was it Costanza from Seinfeld of like taking off his shirt when he goes to the restroom?
Oh, really?
Something like that, yeah.
I had friends when I was in high school that would do that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they're like, well, I've already got my pants off. Might as well be fully naked.
So this just comes from real life then?
I guess so.
That's weird.
I don't know. Maybe they got it from Seinfeld.
Yeah. The other part is like, I think both on the train and on the plane, he recommends going barefoot for the rest of the flight just to let your feet air out.
Yeah.
And I believe that goes against both most airlines policies and Amtrak's policies, but I'm sure you could probably get away with it.
Like, how are they going to know? I mean, I guess if you're walking up and down the aisles without shoes, sure. But if you're sitting in your seat and, you know, you have your feet, like, I mean, I don't know. You have to be a really bored airline attendant to, like, check everybody's feet, I think.
Right. Like, maybe there are bigger fish to fry somewhere.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, anyways, how about some mail?
Let's do some mail.
Yeah, sounds good.
We got mail.
Hey, we got a new sustaining donor.
Yes, we do.
Kathrina, whose last name I will not attempt to obliterate.
Nice of you.
Yes, has signed up to be a recurring donor. And thank you so much, Kathrina.
Thank you very much. She joins Logan and Shadowfoot. And if you would like to help offset some of the costs of our web hosting and getting beer for guests and that sort of thing, you can do so. We really appreciate it, no matter how small. It could be $1 a month, but that's a little income we can depend on and know that we can keep on doing this for you. So thank you so much, Kathrina.
Steve in Wyoming on the Elf Trike.
Speaking of Elf.
Yes. Before I heard the podcast, I saw pictures on your website. My first thought was, this isn't new. I saw these 30 plus years ago. This guy's ripped off a design he saw in Bicycling Magazine. And then I listened to the podcast and realized it's the same guy.
Aha.
Only then there were two wheels and had doors. They were $5,000 in 1981, and I told my partners in a bike shop we would be selling them within 5 years. Well, obviously that deadline has come and gone, but I think the changes he has made in those years make it a viable machine today, and still the same price.
And that's not an easy task with inflation.
No, so, yeah.
Yeah, super stoked on organic transit.
From Jeremy from Critical Transit also adds, might have to go back to working a dead-end office job so I can afford to buy one.
An Elf Trike, that is.
Yes, although it wouldn't be quite as versatile as a bike in congested traffic.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's one of the things I really like about biking throughout the city, especially like, you know, hours around 3, 4, 5,
yeah.
6.
And in Oregon, it's legal to kind of snipe up the right side. I call it sniping, but it's not sniping because it's legal. As far as I know, as long as there's room, you can, in the city of Portland, roll up directly.
Oh, really?
Yep, it's completely legal. Before that, I used to wait in line with the cars. And some people still do. And maybe it's like an ethical, maybe it's not so much about the law for some people as it is like they don't feel right about just going up to the front of the line. But I believe, as far as I know, that's okay.
Huh. Well, I feel so much better about it now. I didn't think it was legal.
You thought you were being all rebellious. So,
well, not even that. Just, you know, if there's room, I'm going to do it. I'm not going to, like, get in front of a car, you know, at the light. But if the car, if I see the car is not turning right, like if they don't have their turn signal on, and I'm still continuing on straight and there's room, I'm going to snake up on the right.
Right. It's like the bike boxes, because basically the idea with the bike box is that you pass the queue of traffic that's waiting at the traffic light and you kind of just plant yourself at the beginning of the line. So,
right.
Yeah, I think that's kind of...
I always thought that was the exception, though.
Right. No, apparently it's the rule.
Oh, cool.
Unless I'm wrong, you can tell us at thesprocketpodcast@gmail.com.
Please do. I don't want to go on living this thug life.
I don't want to be wrong.
From Josh G., he gives us a show review. Oh, yeah. I save this podcast to do dishes to. Nothing motivates me like you guys to do a thorough dish job.
He actually says use guys.
Oh, yeah. He does say use guys.
I feel like we should be using a New York voice then.
Wait, where's this guy from?
Yeah, he's from Cully, I think, here in Portland.
An hour is a lot of dishes. I try not to get the laptop wet. Could you talk a little louder so I could keep it a little farther from the sink?
I'm all in. How you doing, Aaron?
I'm doing great.
All right.
Here
we
are.
How you doing, Josh?
Broadcasting from the People's Republic of Portland.
You finished the dishes yet?
In your kitchen.
That's fantastic. Hope that helps.
It probably won't. My first thought was, well, how about the volume?
Well, yeah. And I think for me, it's usually an earbud is what I use.
I'm sure it's just part of the joke.
I hope so.
Although, you should maybe think of doing your dishes more than just once a week.
Oh, right. But if you have that many dishes in a week, you have a whole hour to do it.
That's true.
Or depending on which podcast feed you're listening to, an hour and 30.
Who am I to say how to
hour
live your
45.
Life? Josh, you just do those dishes whenever you want.
That's right.
Next, Andy from Sacramento. I stumbled onto your podcast last week and have been listening to all of them from the latest on back. As Aaron would say, holy shit.
Trademark.
What an amazing source of great info. I wish there was something like it in Sacramento. All the friendly guests with their great stories and bike advocacy information is too cool. I'm starting a journal based around all the great places and tips everyone mentions.
Ooh.
Ooh.
That's a good pro tip right there.
Yeah. My wife and I are planning a 2-week trip to Portland and plan to tour the region on bike with our two dogs in tow.
That's awesome.
Camping all over the place and checking out the great scenery, beer, coffee, bike shops, and everything else that's possible. Although it will have to be a yearly trip, it seems, due to all this stuff I hear about on your show.
Can't do it all in one.
P.S. When we're in Portland, I'd love to meet up and buy you a beer. Maybe even see your show live.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing. Yeah. We've had a couple people that have listened that they write in. They're like, hey, I'm going to be in Portland. Like Marcus, who made our podcast logo, came in, brought us some beer. And other folks that I'm probably forgetting right now. But
I don't know if we've actually like on the air extended that invitation. But it's always been kind of like, yeah, if you happen to be here on a day in which we are recording and you're free and our guests
totally
are cool with it too.
Yeah.
Then hang out with us.
I would say don't come to Portland expressly to see us produce the show because you'll be disappointed.
No one wants to see the sausage being made.
That's right. And if they do, they're strange. No, not really. I'm just kidding.
Fuebe also came.
Oh, right. That's right. Yeah. Totally. From Boston.
Yeah.
Well, hey, that's a good show, man. We should wrap this up.
Let's put this baby to bed.
All right. Everybody out there, get rid of some stuff you don't need. Ride your damn bike.
And don't forget to brush your teeth.
That's right, because if you do, people won't like you.
Find us on the internet at thesprocketpodcast.com. Send feedback about the program and suggestions for topics or guests. Write to us via email. The address is thesprocketpodcast@gmail.com. Call and leave us a message or text us at 503-847-9774. Connect with us on Twitter at Sprocket Podcast. Thanks to Ryan J. Lane for providing our theme music. Thanks to Herbert for our headline sounder. And thanks to sustaining donors Logan Smith, Shadowfoot, and Katharina Melamgard.
Oh, yeah, and check out X-Ray FM on Twitter as well.
Please.
Please. See you later. All right, take two.
Take two. At least 1 year.
Is that a leaf blower?
There is a leaf blower going on. Sounds like a leaf blower.
Fuck.
Yep.
This is why we need a studio.
I mean, it's not like we could wait that long.
No, it's going to be going for a while. And it's not like right next door.
Yeah.
But usually it's done on Tuesdays, as far as I know.
Today is not Tuesday.
Today is Monday.
Today.
It's a Monday off. It's President's Day, which is... Why would there be a leaf blower on
That's
President's
right.
Day? Washington's birthday, specifically?
It's because their employer is racist.
Probably so. A Sprocket Studios production.